Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
The UFCW on a tear. 14,000 workers in two states get new contracts with higher wages and better benefits. Isn't that what it's all about? Today on the show, the Wobblies are back and with a vengeance, and the latest from the North Coast Labor Federation. Welcome to the Thursday, April 21st edition of America's Workforce, where we are available on at least six platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Pandora, and Stitcher. We have two guests on the show today. We have a newcomer, and that person is Mr. Malcolm Harris, and he is a writer, one of the many very good writers, I might add, with The Nation magazine. You know, it still gets me that this publication has been around since 1865. That's a lot of years for a publication. And they're still publishing for very good reason. They've got great stories, great writers, like the one you're going to hear in a couple of minutes. The story today deals with the Wobblies. Now, who are the Wobblies? Well, these are the industrial workers of the world. And if you know anything about labor history, this is quite a radical group. Starting in the early 1900s, the Wobblies, or the International Workers of the World, enlisted tens of thousands of members, regardless of their work, from dockers to lumbermen to birdcage makers, telephone switchboard operators. Yeah, they had such a thing back then. The Wobblies specialize in unauthorized wildcat strikes, even use sabotage to offset the owner's advantages. And they had quite a success until probably 1920, and that's when the corporate types got together, hired a lot of armed guards. They got pretty violent. People lost their lives, and that pretty much put an end to the organizing. Well, the Wobblies resurfaced almost 20 years ago. We're talking about 2003-2004, and they started organizing at Starbucks. And look what has happened. We have 200-plus locations of Starbucks being organized today. Now, workers have lost their jobs, let's be honest there, at least a couple dozen so far. In a nutshell, we're talking about organizing from the bottom up. And this is a group, Starbucks and those at Amazon in New York. We're going to touch on that as well, the Staten Island warehouse. They had no affiliation with a major union or the AFL-CIO, which over the years, the AFL-CIO has not been involved in this until this movement started with the fast food workers about 10 years ago. And there's various reasons for that. The organizing is harder. The workers have left less to offer in dues, things like that. And we're going to touch on all of these with Malcolm as our first guest on the show. Later in the show, we're going to check in with Pat Gallagher on behalf of the North Coast Labor Federation. We've got a couple of issues and events to talk about. The Coalition of Labor Union Women, better known as CLU, is organizing their Ohio Statewide Women's Conference, which will be held at the beginning of June, June 3rd and 4th. The attendees will participate in a meet-and-greet reception on Friday, June 3rd, and there'll be a breakfast with a special celebrity guest, Kim Coles. That'll be on Saturday. This is a statewide conference. And then later in June, the A. Philip Randolph Institute Ohio State Education Conference will get it underway in downtown Cleveland, Ohio. And the theme there is Our Power, Our Decision, Our Vote. Yeah, mobilizing the vote. And then we'll also touch on the guidance, which was issued on Monday of this week from the Biden administration. We talked about this on the show a couple of days ago. And this was guidance on buying American products when it comes to rebuilding our infrastructure. We have the law in place. And there were some specific clauses written into that law emphasizing that we have to buy American. Right now, if the content is 55% made in America, that's okay. You know, we think about that. That's not good enough. 55%. So it's 50%. Yeah, it's a majority. But the Biden administration wants to increase that to 60% now, 65% in 2024, and then 75% American content by 2029. So there is a push. And if it happens fast enough, that would be good. There's waivers, like there always is waivers with this. If they can't find an American product, then they can go elsewhere. So they were pretty specific about that in the declaration on Monday. So Pat Gallagher will be our second guest on the show today. Well, I must say the food and commercial workers are on a roll. Last week, over 13,000 members of the United Food and Commercial Workers Locals 8GS, 135, 324, 770, 1167, and 1428, all of them, who work at 170 Stater Brothers stores. This is in Southern California. They ratified a new contract that strengthens wages and benefits, provides guaranteed minimum work hours, and protects pensions. The deal was reached after months of negotiations and active participation by tens of thousands of California's essential grocery workers. Comment here from the union. After more than 2 years, of risking their lives to serve California's communities as essential workers, the members of the UFCW stood together for their families and each other and secured one of the most historic contracts in California labor history. This contract is a concrete and direct result of their tireless work. That was a joint statement from all of those locals. Boy, there's a lot of them there. One, two, three, four, five, six locals, 170 stores. Meanwhile, some 1,000 members of the United Food and Commercial Workers who work at Cars in Anchorage, Alaska, and Eagle River, Alaska, have ratified a new three-year contract. The new agreement includes significant pay increases, improved upward mobility, earning potential, better paid sick leave, increased access to dental and vision coverage, and improved worker safety, which is pretty darn important. Members of Local, again, this is the Food and Commercial Workers, 1496, voted unanimously to approve an industry-leading contract that is among the most competitive for food and commercial workers in the state of Alaska. That comment from Frank Munchie. Frank's the president of 1496. This agreement, he said, which was secured after 10 months of talks, ensures workers will receive first day paid sick leave, receive fair pay and wage increases, and have access to affordable, quality health care. The negotiated wage increases means that over the next 18 months, many of our members will earn 17% raises, some even higher. That's unheard of. That's a powerful union. Again, we're talking Alaska here. Cost of living, yeah, it's definitely higher over there. Frank went on to say the agreement also reduces the length of wage progressions, increasing the upward mobility and earning potential for their members. Furthermore, the contract gives us a real say in scheduling and workplace safety conditions. Hats off to Local 1496. Wow, that's a great deal there. And one more here. More than 250 workers at Consumer Reports voted overwhelmingly to ratify a new five-year contract. Now, they are members of the Consumer Reports Guild, which has been affiliated with the News Guild, CWA, for more than 70 years. That new contract includes guaranteed wage increases of 14.2% over the life of the contract, a $3,000 ratification bonus, up to 12 weeks of parental leave at full pay, creation of a joint labor management program, equity and inclusion They have a committee for that, diversity, equity, and inclusion, and expanded use of paid sick leave and more. Richard Handel is the unit chair at Consumer Reports, said, "I'm extremely proud of the bargaining committee and the support that our guild colleagues have given us during two often acrimonious years of bargaining. From the start, we fought back against management's retrogressive proposals and piddly wage offers. As a result, I'm happy to say we got a pretty good contract." Oh, yeah, definitely. None of this, think about this, none of this would happen if you didn't have a strong union behind you. All right, we have to take a break. When we come back, our segment with The Nation magazine, Malcolm Harris will be joining us talking about the Wobblies. They're back, and they're ready to rock. Back in a few minutes.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
It takes LIUNA to build North America's infrastructure. From roads and bridges to schools and skyscrapers, the men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, build the projects we depend on. From constructing the Freedom Tower on the site of the former World Trade Center to untangling Washington, D.C.'s congested interstate, LIUNA members do the work that matters. Find out what it takes to be built by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
America's Workforce appreciates our sponsor, the Columbus Central Ohio Building and Construction Trades Council, who represents more than 18,000 workers from 19 affiliated local unions and district councils.
The Heat and Frost Insulators and Allied Workers are proud to be a title sponsor for America's Workforce Radio. The Insulators Union is leading the way in the mechanical insulation industry, fire stopping, and infectious disease control. Regarded as North America's energy conservation specialist, these professionals are known for their professional work and dedication. You can learn more about the Insulators Union at insulators.org.
Union members need to be heard. Reliable and convenient union voting has never been more important than it is now. Make voting easy for your membership by working with survey and ballot systems. SBS offers encrypted and monitored solutions that ensure your elections are accurate and accessible for every member through mail-in, online, and in-person voting. Visit surveyandballotsystems.com and take the next step in getting secure and auditable elections.
The AFL-CIO is a proud sponsor of America's Workforce Radio. United by efforts to raise wages, listeners to this show and workers all across America are beginning to turn a corner and drive the economic debate. The AFL-CIO is comprised of 12.5 million working people from 56 unions, but we stand with and fight for everyone who is working for a better life. For more information about our raising wages agenda, go to aflcio.org.
America's Workforce is sponsored in part by Boyd Watterson Asset Management, LLC. Find out more about our investment solutions tailored to meet the needs of Taft-Hartley funds at boydwatterson.com.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And don't forget, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle AWF Union Podcast, AWF Union Podcast. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the Ohio Federation of Teachers. You can find more at oh.aft.org. And if you missed the show with Melissa Cropper 2 days ago, Melissa, of course, the president of the OFT, got to listen. I mean, we covered a lot of ground, including the story about substitute teachers and how they're actually lowering the standards. In some cases, you just don't even need a college degree to teach, but that's what's happening because of the shortage, and it's a real tough situation to negotiate. And you can check that show out at awfradio.com, plus all the different podcasts that we are on, at least six of them, as I mentioned at the top of the show. Right now, let's go to Washington, D.C. And joining us, this is our segment we do each and every month with The Nation magazine. And joining us is Malcolm Harris, and he's author of an article, "We Can Thank the Wobblies for the Biggest Labor Story of the Year, The Radical Tactics of the International Workers of the World Are Better Suited to the Bleak U.S. Jobs Landscape than Those of Mainstream Trade Unions." Yeah, there's a different kind of organizing going on in America right now. Malcolm Harris, welcome to the show today. How are we doing, brother?
Doing well. Thanks for having me.
So talk to me about this article, and I think the best way to start off is to explain to our listeners what the Wobblies are. I mean, we're going back a long time here, probably the early 1900s, and I guess they've kind of reinvented themselves. Talk to me about that first, Malcolm.
Yeah, we're talking about a formation that's existed in the United States for and beyond for over 100 years now. That really comes out of the early 20th century West, the American West, the labor scene, which was a hard place to organize at the time because it didn't have the same union backgrounds that other parts of the country did. And so you had a place where employers had tons and tons of power, whether this was logging or the docks or other places. You've got in the area very powerful employers, very weak labor. Mm-hmm. And so it's within that context that this Industrial Workers of the World, IWW, formed, which is their whole strategy is about one big union, right? It's an industrial union that's supposed to include all workers, all members of the working class. And it specifically appealed to these underrepresented workers of the West 100 years ago. And they're known now for what they did at the time, which was really radical organizing, rank-and-file-based organizing that wasn't afraid to fight back against the employers' hired thugs that were always ready to crack some heads to prevent organizing in these industries.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about a time period from 1905 to 1920, and I was reading in your article that the University of Washington's History Project documented in that time period about 400 labor actions led by the Wobblies. And as you pointed out, they were a radical bunch. So what happened? Did they finally kind of run out of steam here or what?
Well, what you have is the Red Scare around World War I, right? So you have the Wobblies are an internationalist union. So this is at the stage when left-wing ideologies are still forming, right? You haven't even had the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia yet. And so the question of how the working class is going to organize is really up in the air. And the Wobblies were filling that gap in the United States as this sort of far-left labor organizing group. And when World War I happens, you know, they are like the Bolsheviks in Russia, right, opposed to the war, which they see as a war on the global working class, right? The working class needs to step up and prevent the war, as they did in Russia. And so at that point, American authorities come cracking down real hard on the left in a way that we still see now. We're still inheriting the legacy of that first Red Scare crackdown that happens against the Wobblies. And by putting them on the wrong side of this national cause, right, this national war, they were able to marginalize left labor within the American political spectrum.
I see. So they kind of like disappeared. They were dormant for a long time.
Yeah, well, people got killed. People got cracked on the head. I mean, it was a very harsh period.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they put them in the ground, let's be honest. I mean,
absolutely.
That's exactly what happened. And if you take a look at labor history, you'll see that in the various parts of the country. I mean, the miners, the Haymarket strike. I mean, we could go on and on and on. I mean, there were some brutal times in labor history in America. So let's fast forward to what's going on today. And you point out in your article about the Starbucks campaign, and what was it, 2004, 2005? Talk to me about that part.
So the Wobblies are a suppressed part of the American labor world, but always existing, right? Because of the nature of the organization, which is that anyone can join, you don't have to pay dues, any member of the working class can be a Wobbly, you can be a Wobbly and you can be a member of another union. It's basically impossible to kill off the IWW, as capitalists have found. And so when you hit the 21st century, and the Starbucks campaign in particular, you have Wobbly stepping up and saying, we're going to organize low-wage workers, that low-wage workers traditionally conceived of not just by people in general, but by the official labor movement as, you know, half jobs, not jobs worth organizing because they're not skilled enough. Like a Starbucks barista, for example, the Wobblies say all members of the working class are worth organizing. We're going to organize. We're going to try and organize Starbucks. And that campaign does not succeed, but it starts setting off this, I think, chain reaction of low wage organizing. That one thing that I got criticized for not including in the column that I think is a right note is this intermediate campaign of Fight for 15, where you see national unions picking up on this low wage organizing and saying low wage workers are a big part of the American wage force. Not just teenagers, not just these minimum wage workers are real workers, right? We need to get in there and start organizing. And that's something that the Wobbly strategy is really influenced.
Yeah, a lot of people don't realize the people working in fast food in those lower wage jobs are the ones that worked in steel mills, in auto plants. And those are the plants that disappeared. So it's the race to the bottom. They took what was available. And those jobs were not unionized. So that's what's happening. I love your line here in the article, Malcolm. Unionizing Starbucks baristas was like unionizing the Death Star stormtroopers. Both impossible and pointless. Love that line. So that being said, how did it gain momentum here? I mean, and you got to keep in mind that the AFL-CIO really at first wasn't all that interested. Maybe you could speak to that part. Let's start there.
Yeah, we've had a long period between the beginning of the IWW campaign, not long historically, but relatively long in our contemporary time, between the beginning of these attempts to organize these chain workers, right? Because we have this consolidation. It's important to notice the consolidation that we have among retailers and employers in the 90s and 2000s, right? So instead of having a million local coffee shops that there's no way to organize a union of all local coffee shop workers or whatever, you have Starbucks comes in and wipes all those businesses off the map and replaces them with Starbucks. So this chain business has an effect on the employment landscape that makes it in some ways more susceptible to organizing. And that's something that the Wobblies have really put forth and that other unions have then picked up what they've been putting down. I think it's an important analysis of the situation that's starting to bear fruit. And we're starting to see, it's funny, the headline for the piece is now, as you know, totally outdated because the biggest labor story of the year is no longer Starbucks, but Amazon. But you see a lot of the same conditions, right, where these are low-wage jobs that the unions have been sort of, the official unions, the big unions have been sort of loath to try and organize Starbucks or Amazon warehouse workers because that would be difficult. And now you see a rank-and-file union, one that I would say is well within the sort of Wobbly tradition, step up and say, we're going to do it, we're going to organize ourselves.
Mm-hmm. So you're referring to the Amazon Labor Union, the ALU,
absolutely,
which is
ALU.
It's kind of like a Wobbly. Then they're not actually the Wobblies, though.
No. They're not IWW affiliated, but it's or the rank and file union, right? They didn't. It wasn't the SEIU coming in and say we're going to try and organize this workplace. You have the Christian Smalls and the other groups and the other members of the ALU organizing committee who stepped up as rank and file workers to say they're going to organize themselves. And I think that's well within the tradition of Wobbly organizing.
And to my knowledge, they did a GoFundMe campaign. We're talking about the Amazon workers in Staten Island, the warehouse workers. And I believe they raised about $100,000, which in the scheme of things really isn't very much, but they were very effective, though. In fact, I believe the retail workers union, which is one down in Bessemer, Alabama, was going to offer them support, and they said, "No, we want to do this on our own." So I'm thinking this might be a different kind of organizing. In fact, you know what? I got to take a break. Could we talk about that in the next segment here, Malcolm?
Let's do it.
Yeah, Malcolm Harris joining us on our live line again. This is the segment that we do each and every month with The Nation magazine. We're talking about the Wobblies, going back
well over 100 years. We can thank the Wobblies for the biggest labor story of the year, talking about the Starbucks. And we'll throw in Amazon as well, because it's a different kind of organizing. We'll continue that right after this. Later in the show, Pat Gallagher will be joining us on behalf of the North Coast Labor Federation.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
It takes LIUNA to power North America with affordable energy. The men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, have the skills needed to build and maintain oil, natural gas, nuclear, solar, and wind projects that are shaping America's energy future. From new energy tech to retrofitted facilities, LIUNA members do it all. Find out what it takes to be powered by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
American workers are the best in the world, but we face an uphill battle against countries like China that don't play by the rules. There's a bill right now in Congress that would give American workers the trade tools we need to fight back and win. Join me in telling Congress to pass this bill. Visit AmericanManufacturing.org to learn how.
Paid for by the Alliance for American Manufacturing.
The United Steelworkers of America represent over 70,000 workers in the state of Ohio. Steelworker members enjoy the benefits of some of the best contracts of any workers in the world. Many of your friends, neighbors, and relatives are members of one of the most effective democratic unions in our country. With the pressures unorganized workers are under in today's economy, you need to join them. So call the Steelworkers Organizing Office at 216-292-5683 or toll free at 1-800-443-3752.
Chris LaGrange here, host of UCOM Live with Chris LaGrange. News, talk, sports, and workforce politics. The fastest growing podcast on, in, and around the internet. Join us live every Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and Twitter with archives on UCOMLive.com. Our loud and colorful panelists bring you current events like no other. So follow and subscribe today wherever great podcasts are found.
From the Golden Gate Bridge to the St. Louis Gateway Arch, the Sears Tower, and just about every building, bridge, and structure in between, our cities and towns wouldn't be the same without ironworkers. With over 3,000 contractors employing more than 130,000 highly trained ironworkers and 20,000 apprentices, the Ironworkers Union stands ready and able to shape the future of our skylines. Learn more at ironworkers.org. Ironworkers, the sky's the limit.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And don't forget, we are available on at least six platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Pandora, and Stitcher. When you get an opportunity, just sign up, receive our shows on a regular basis, and give us a rating. We always appreciate those five-star ratings, so keep them coming. And more people are giving us five stars. Greatly appreciated. Let's go back to Washington right now. Joining us on our live line is Malcolm Harris, author of an article about the Wobblies. And this is a group, the International Workers of the World, which, they made a lot of history well over 100 years ago. And they're back at Starbucks, not at Amazon. But the whole point here is organizing without the help of the AFL-CIO or the SEIU or the retail workers. And Malcolm, I want to talk to you about that. You did a lot of research, and I appreciate you coming to the table today to talk about it. Do you feel with what's going on here, and you know how difficult it is to organize, and it's going to be difficult for the Amazon workers in New York. They got to get that first contract. But I'm wondering here, is this the wave of the future? How do you feel about that? Because it's workers speaking out, rank and file. What's your thoughts?
Absolutely. Well, I think we can see this structural trend where job quality is decreasing, right? Jobs are getting worse. They're getting lower paid, more exploitative. And so an organizing model that's based on jobs being good, right? An organizing model that's based on high-wage jobs that have high pay for high dues, that can support their own kind of organizing apparatus, jobs that are skilled and where the population of people who can do the job is very limited, so they can maintain a sort of guild-like control over wages. That model, the more and more jobs get worse, falls out of favor, right? We can't can't use that model if you don't have the workers to support that. And I think there are big parts of the official labor movement that sort of stuck their flag in that kind of organizing and fought what was ultimately a losing battle to maintain those jobs, and don't have the same kind of strategy for organizing low-wage workers. And it might, that it hasn't been worth it. It hasn't been worth it in the past to organize those workers because it's too hard. The advantages that the employers have are too great. And the rewards in terms of building the movement, in terms of the resources you can pull out of that place once you've got it organized, are much lower. And so that then that leaves it up to people who are the rank and file workers, because they're the only ones for whom organizing themselves is worth it. And so I think we do start to see that. And that doesn't mean that national unions haven't been involved. I think you said that they've offered support in the ALU, and they, I think they've given support to the ALU a little bit. And definitely the Starbucks campaign that we're seeing now is associated with national unions. So it's not, I don't mean to say they're doing nothing or whatever. But in terms of the larger strategy, we need one that fits a workforce that's increasingly low wage.
Let's talk about the low wages here, because I'm thinking the fact that they are low wage jobs, and you know, in any organizing campaign, workers are going to lose their job. They're going to get fired. I know Starbucks has done that in various locations. Amazon has done that. All companies do that. When they find out that there's organizers at a place of business, they're going to make it very difficult for those workers to stay there. But when it comes to low-wage jobs, they probably are saying to themselves, what do I have to lose? I'm not making all that much money anyway. If I lose my job, I'll just find another one. Do you think that that plays a part in all of this, Malcolm?
I think it's a bit speculative, so I don't want to speculate too much. But I think that, yeah, that definitely could be part of it, that you have workers who've got, and especially during the past couple of years in the pandemic, where you had a lot of job openings on the low, it's not that all there were also sudden lots of great jobs you could get, but there were a lot of openings in low wage jobs. And so if you got fired from your lower wage job, there was a good chance that you could find perhaps even a better one in the same sector. And so I think that definitely encouraged people, along with the pandemic unemployment guarantees, encourage people to take kind of risks that they might not have been able to in the past. And
yeah,
I would guess that that's part of what we're seeing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, plus you throw in a friendly NLRB, so things are better. You've got a union-friendly guy in the White House. I mean, the environment is much better for unions right now, let's be honest. Now, I want to switch to the higher-paid jobs, because you talk about this in your article, some organizing going on at Google and other Silicon Valley companies, the tech industry. Now, they pay higher wages, but we're also seeing some organizing going on there. In fact, you point out, and this is in a book called Labor Law for the Rank and Filer, co-written by Daniel Gross, who's a former Wobbly, who launched the Starbucks campaign back in 2004. So we're seeing the same kind of thing in those industries as well, right? And how is that panning out?
Well, you're seeing, I think it's something parallel, because the situations where workers are disadvantaged, right? That's what I think Daniel Gross is writing about. He's writing about solidarity unionism. Situations where you might not be able to win a vote in your workplace, where maybe your employer has too much control. Maybe they'll just fire everybody in the Starbucks case. But then in a Google case, maybe you're disadvantaged because you get paid a lot. And so it's harder to organize your colleagues into the union because they don't have the same kind of complaints that lower wage workers might. They might identify with management in a different way than lower wage workers do. But that doesn't mean you can't still organize your workplace. And so they're picking up these strategies that lower wage workers are using and finding them useful for themselves in these higher wage jobs, because they're still facing a situation where there's too much power on the employer side.
So, Malcolm, what do you see here for the future? We kind of touched on this. I just want to, I know we're speculating a little bit. We're watching this unfold right before our eyes, and it is interesting. It's exciting at the same time. How do you see this panning out? Do you think maybe the AFL-CIO might get a little more engaged? Do you see more businesses trying to go union as a result of the environment right now? What's your thoughts on that?
I wouldn't be surprised if we see, especially in this tight labor market, if you see some firms looking to unionize as a way to attract high and maintain high quality workers. So that would make sense. But I think it's we should be cautious when we're looking at the situation, because there's a long way to go. People see the victories and the votes at Starbucks, and they see the victories at Amazon, and they've been surprising and exciting, and for me as well. But there is a long road ahead to getting a contract and actually voting and approving a contract. And Amazon in particular, but Starbucks as well, has really high worker turnover. So you've got to be imagining that they're looking at a strategy right now to kick these unions out, you know, before you get a contract, first contract even, to get rid of the union by bringing in a new set of workers and revoting. That's what I would imagine is they're thinking about in terms of strategies, because I don't think these models for Amazon or Starbucks work with union labor. It's very hard to imagine Amazon in particular, I think, because they find their profits so often in their direct control over worker conditions and their ability to experiment and constantly be transforming and making more efficient labor practices. It's not even the wages, which is so often the focus. Is Amazon can afford the wages. What they can't afford is having a partner that they're forced to actually work with on the labor side, right? Not being able to just transform jobs constantly, because that's what they do, transform this job constantly. And unions put a stop to that, right? Because you have to get the approval for the kind of transformations you're making to the job before you make them. So I think we're in for a real knockdown, drag-out fight. But it's hard to bet against the workers right now, too, because everyone who has been, and there have been a lot of people, even within the labor movement, who've been betting against these people, and they've lost a couple times in a row now.
Right, right. It's an interesting time, no doubt about that, in so many different ways. Malcolm Harris, author of the article we're talking about, we can thank the Wobblies for the biggest labor story of the year. You know, I want to mention, too, you're also an author of a book, The Kids Aren't All Right. And this came out, I'm looking like 5 years ago. And I thought this was kind of interesting. The subtitle, A Crucial New Work of Generational Analysis, explores how society turned millennials into human capital. Briefly, can you expand on this? I mean, you piqued my interest on this. Go ahead.
Sure. So, yeah, it seems so old now. But the premise of that book, which I think has become more and more common sense as far as people talk about it, is that you have this cohort of people whose sense of self has been formed around their usefulness for employment, right? Their usefulness as a site of profit production. And so we talk about human capital, we're not talking about us as people, we're talking about us as tools within the labor process. And so the book analyzes the production, the making of millennials is what I call it, from this perspective of human capital and the production process and the increasing rate of exploitation. So definitely relates to that question of job quality decreasing and what happens when your experience of your young life has been shaped by the decrease of job quality.
Certainly quite fascinating. Again, Kids These Days, Human Capital and the Making of Millennials came out 5 years ago, but it's still a good read. And of course, The Nation magazine, we can thank the Wobblies for the biggest labor story of the year. And I think there's a lot more labor stories, big labor stories headed our way. Malcolm, thank you so much for your time, and let's keep in touch. I'm sure you'll have some good articles down the road that we can talk about here on America's Workforce. How's that sound?
Absolutely. Look forward to coming back.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. Pat Gallagher on behalf of the North Coast Labor Federation coming up next.
This is America's Workforce.
It takes LIUNA to keep America running. Over 70,000 public employees are part of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America. delivering critical services such as healthcare and emergency response, as well as maintaining roads and sanitation systems. Even the National Postal Mail Handlers Union, representing over 47,000 U.S. postal workers, is affiliated with LIUNA. Find out what it takes for LIUNA to keep America running at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
We're the nurses, firefighters, and claims representatives that help keep our government services running. We respond to natural disasters. We care for our nation's veterans, and we investigate discrimination in the workplace. We are federal and D.C. government workers, and we are proud to serve the American people. Working in more than 70 agencies across the government, we know we can fulfill our mission because our union has our back. Learn more at AFGE.org. Paid for by the American Federation of Government Employees, AFL-CIO.
American workers are the best in the world, but we face an uphill battle against countries like China that don't play by the rules. There's a bill right now in Congress that would give American workers the trade tools we need to fight back and win. Join me in telling Congress to pass this bill. Visit AmericanManufacturing.org to learn how.
Paid for by the Alliance for American Manufacturing.
There is unity and strength for workers.
We are the USW.
We are the USW.
The United Steelworkers.
The largest industrial union in North America.
We represent 850,000 members in the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean.
We work in metals,
rubber,
chemicals,
paper,
oil refining, atomic energy, and the service sector.
We are steelworkers, standing strong and fighting for what's right.
America's Workforce Radio is sponsored in part by the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, District Council 6, representing painters, glazers, drywall finishers, and sign and display industry workers. They remind you that belonging to a union is your right as an American.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferentz with America's Workforce.
And remember, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle AWF Union Podcast, AWF Union Podcast. Let's go to line number two, and joining us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania today, which is the headquarters for the United Steelworkers, is Mr. Pat Gallagher, who is the District 1 rep. Mr. Gallagher, how are we doing today, my brother?
Doing okay, Flash. How about you?
Good, good, good. Now, that merger with Ohio and Michigan, is that a done deal as far as District 1? Is that right?
Yeah, what happened was we had a retirement for one of the directors in Michigan and Wisconsin, which was District 2, and the International Executive Board decided to split the district in half, and Michigan is going to be part of the Ohio district now, and Wisconsin is going to be part of the Indiana-Illinois district going forward.
Gotcha. So, it's going to be an interesting
time. I know
time
I'm not happy about having all these Michigan fans in our district now, but we'll have to deal with it.
I was just thinking of the Buckeyes and the Wolverines. That's going to be real interesting coming up in November.
Yes, it is. So,
okay, what's taking you to Pittsburgh today? Talk to me about that.
Well, today we're having a basic steel industry conference. It's a conference that we call right prior to master negotiations starting, where we give all the affiliated delegates who belong to locals that are involved in the steel industry. We give them an update on the industry and trends that are happening and pricing, and so trying to give them a little bit of education piece going into negotiations.
I gotcha. And this is a normal thing, normal course of events, I take it?
Yeah, it happens every time we get into master negotiations, we do a conference. So
yeah. What's the atmosphere on that? You know, we've got prices going up all across the board, steel prices going up, no doubt about that. Obviously, wages have to reflect that. What's the mood right now, Pat?
Well, right now everybody's pretty positive. The demand is good. Demand is holding. Price has been fluctuating up and down, but it's still a good price. It's a holding price. It's well over $1,000 for a hot rolled ton. So that's a good price where the companies can make significant profits, and we're hoping those prices hold out through negotiations. The master agreements expire September 1st. We plan on starting bargaining in right after 4th of July, and hopefully we'll have an agreement on time, which we haven't had for several years.
That would be good. It would be real. Yeah, I was just talking about the food and commercial workers. They got some good deals for workers in California and Alaska, but it took like 2 years to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. We got to move a little quicker than that.
Let's talk about this guidance. Talked about this on the show extensively on Tuesday. And in the infrastructure legislation, which is law, and it's starting to happen, the money's starting to filter through various states right now, there's specific guidance to buy American products. And on Monday of this week, the Biden administration kind of clarified a few things. And I saw the statement on the steelworkers website from Tom Conway. Obviously, he's happy about this. Steelworkers have been first and foremost when it comes to buying American steel. So I guess my question right now is, how do you feel about that? Is there enough clarity on all of this?
Now, we're very enthused with the administration's issuing of the guidance applications. The new guidance applicable to all the federal financially assisted programs where funds were made available for the through the infrastructure bill and for infrastructure projects. It had three real key sourcing requirements that we were really pleased with. The first one was about all iron and steel, that it had to be melted and poured in the United States. There was a standard before where it said processed and finished, which would let foreign slabs come in or semi-finished products come in, and then they could be finished in an American mill and be called American product. This way, the product's got to be melted in the United States and finished in the United States to be considered American steel, which is the standard that we were looking for. Also, we probably need to add in their mine in there also, too. So this it would be sourced from, raw materials would be sourced from American mines and domestic mines. But also, that all the manufactured products to be considered a manufactured product of United States origin, it had to be more than 55% of the total cost of the of all the components of it. And those, and that's a sliding scale where it goes up through the term of the guidance. It goes to 60% this October, and then 75% by 2029. Mm-hmm. We still think that the guidance leaves room for potential escalation if things look like we can get a higher percentage, which we'll always be pushing for, trying to get as high a percentage as we can. And also, too, that all construction materials must be made in the United States, either manufactured or be raw materials that are from the proceeding and manufacturing stage. They have to be from the United States. So those are three big guidance that we will help workers and help manufacturers in the United States.
And Pat, as you know, over the years, there's been waivers on all of this, but it appears what the administration said this week, you got to exhaust every opportunity. You got to make every attempt to buy the products in the United States before you go elsewhere. And that's got to make you feel pretty good, huh?
No, we think, too, that the general waivers that were in place now, there's a much stricter requirement to get a waiver, which is what we wanted. Before, it was pretty wide open how you could get around some of the Buy American provisions. But the Biden administration has tightened that up very well. So it's something we're very pleased about, and hopefully going forward it'll work well and it'll increase the demand for American-made products.
And where are we right now when it comes to a foreign steel coming into the United States? I know China has really sucked the oxygen out of the room when it comes to making steel. Where are we? What are the numbers right now, Pat?
Yeah, that was one thing that we talked about at the Basic Steel Conference today was the global capacity, the global total global capacity of steel making in the world. China accounts for 5.13% of all global steel production. And it's even worse than aluminum, where they're 57% of all the aluminum. So 51.3% of all steel that's made in this world is made in China. 57% of all aluminum is made in China.
Wow. So they got a majority. That's amazing. That's amazing. Yes, one more question.
And that's not by accident. That's by design.
Oh, yeah.
That's because their government made projects and made investments. And that's why we are encouraging the Biden administration to do the same thing so we could rebuild our industries and our manufacturing, not only steel and aluminum, but all manufacturing.
Yeah. Fight the same fight here. You mentioned the melted and poured steel in the United States. I can only assume that that should create more jobs in the industry if they're going that route. What's your thoughts?
Well, we're hoping it creates more jobs, and we're hoping it also creates more facilities being constructed. If we want to make a dent in this 51.3% of the global production that China has, we need to have some new facilities. We've lost a lot of steel-making facilities in the last last decade or so. We lost Lorraine, Warren. We've lost Steubenville, all in, you know, close to in Ohio, where we had steel manufacturing, steel making that doesn't exist anymore. So we need to take a look at rebuilding some of those plants and some of those products, and even build some new plants somewhere else where we can continue to grow our industry.
Absolutely. And it can be done. It's been done before. It can be done again, no doubt about it. Okay, I'm looking at the calendar here. You got a really busy June. I saw there's this coalition of labor union women organizing conference. That's early June. You got the AFL-CIO convention in Philadelphia. That's like middle of June, I think June 12th. And then at the end of June, there's a conference in Cleveland. The A. Philip Randolph Institute, Ohio State Education Conference, and obviously this one's about pushing the vote, making sure that everybody are registered and they exercise their right to vote. So I'm going to let you pick it up from here. I would imagine you're going to be involved, engaged in all of this. Talk to me about that, Pat.
Yes, it's. We're pretty happy that the constituency groups of the AFL-CIO, the Coalition of Labor Union Women, and the A. Philip Randolph Institute have picked Cleveland, Ohio, to have their statewide conferences. So we're pretty happy about that. A. Philip Randolph's going to hold theirs on June 24th, 26th at the Renaissance Hotel. It's going to be a power-packed event with a lot of workshops, a lot of education, a lot of speakers. Mayor Bibbs even committed to be the dinner speaker, so it should be a good event and should be hopefully well attended here. And also the Coalition of Labor Union Women, they're holding their event on June 3rd, June 4th in downtown Cleveland. They've got, it's going to start on Friday where they're going to have a reception and meet and greet, and they're going to have statewide conference will follow on Saturday, June 4th.
What about the AFL-CIO convention that's going to be held in Philadelphia? That's where the vote will be for Liz Shuler and Fred Redman. Fred, the Secretary.
Yeah, that's the national convention. It's held every 4 years, and that's when we elect the national AFL-CIO president. Liz Shuler is running. Right now, she's filling for the interim of the late Rich Trumka. She'll be running for a whole full term coming up in June. And Fred Redman, who was a former vice president for the United Steelworkers, is now the secretary treasurer of the AFL-CIO, and he'll be running for re-election also.
Is there any opposition candidates to your knowledge right now?
We haven't heard. There was some scuttlebutt, some talking around, but we haven't. Nobody has actually declared yet or been that we know of that are trying to get votes. So we're hoping that it'll be a consensus election, and we could go forward and continue to build the labor movement. I think Liz has been doing a great job filling Rich's shoes and trying to draw in there. We've also had a conference call with her the other day talking about the Labor 2022 program, and hopefully they'll get some help from the national here in Ohio. And I'm pleased to report that Ohio was still considered a battleground state, which was good news for us. So there will be some resources coming into Ohio.
Well, it's a battleground state. Once we get our redistricting done, you think that's going to happen here shortly, or what?
Well, we primaries going on for everything but the Ohio legislative seats and the state school boards right now. So that'll be May 3rd. We'll have yet to see what's going to happen for the legislative seats, Ohio legislative seats, and the state school board. So hopefully we'll have some kind of determination on that and when the primary is going to be.
There you go. Yeah, a lot of things in play right now. Well, Mr. Gallagher, you take care. You're in the middle of it all. Pat Gallagher, District 1 representative for the United Steelworkers, also with us as part of the North Coast Labor Federation segment, one of the many sponsors of America's Workforce. You take care. Stay safe. We'll talk to you next month, all right?
All right. Thanks, Flash.
That's it for another edition of America's Workforce. Coming up tomorrow, our segment called Working Class Perspectives and more from the United Steelworkers. Until then, all of you have a safe and wonderful day.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.